It'll be first and 25.
First and 25, the Football Zebras podcast, season two. And we're back from our off-season break with Deputy Editor Cam Philippe, Editor Chris Soibert, and our writer-analyst Pat Weber. I'm Ben Ostro, Editor-in-Chief. So we had a nice long off-season. Game one of the kickoff weekend, 6 seconds in, we have our controversy. So it doesn't fail to deliver the 2025 season. We have what we've been calling in the background Spitgate, and it seems to be getting around because it seemed to crop up in the Florida, South Florida game the other day. So basically, let's step through this from an officiating standpoint. That flag came out right away, and quickly we saw the ejection.
Yeah, I mean, in both cases, I mean, for better or worse, the offender was right in front of the official. And thankfully, they both saw it, obviously, and popped the flag. And that's, in general, a cardinal sin. I know I saw a couple comments out there where it's, oh, that's soft. It's like, no, spitting on an opponent is a cardinal sin in any sport. And that's why in 6 seconds we had that ejection.
Yeah, you know, one of the big differences between a good official and a great official is dead ball officiating and awareness. And especially with the Jalen Carter situation, the umpire in that game, Brian Neal, I believe, noticed a Jalen Carter going towards the opponent's huddle, which is send up alarm bells right away. He does a great job of just walking over there, just probably to get him back and just see what's going on. So he's right there when something happens and he can see it happen and rule on it and make sure that it's not missed.
And the other point, Cam, is you don't get a warm up in this, in any game. You have to be ready to go. Even if you're in a dead ball period with an injury right off the kickoff.
Yeah. We didn't even have a play from scrimmage, and this just seemed to fall right into Brian Neal's lap, so to speak. And it's obviously something, like Chris said, it is one of those unmentionables. Like, that's something you don't even think about doing. But at the same time, it's also something that can go unseen very easily if you're not keen on your dead ball mechanics and staying involved. If players are getting too close to the other side, or to the other huddle, excuse me, you got to be close. You don't have to be right in between them every time, but just keeping an eye out for things like that. Obviously, these are two bitter rivals, so anything can happen at any level of the sport, in any sport. So Brian Neal was right where he needed to be, and just so happened that this unmentionable happened to take place. Now, again, there's the controversy back and forth of, oh, did Dak Prescott spit at him first, at Jalen Carter, before he spit back? Again, that can be, you can show that it's the same thing as a football act. This is obviously a non-football act. That's why they were very quick with the disqualification, but it goes the same thing with a football act. We can parse it and watch the replay slowly and say, oh, you know, he spit a little, Dak Prescott spit a little, but again, it kind of goes the same way as just a regular football act. You can't use the replay and go frame by frame and say, oh, you know, the official should have seen that Dak spit first. So, you know, did he? Maybe. Right at him? I don't know. But at the end of the day, it's something that the league, not just the league, any organization that deals with competitive sports doesn't want in the game. So they very swiftly and efficiently took care of it.
And to be right on top of that, because you could have put a situation out there where, yes, Jalen Carter, you know, is a key player on the defense, but far, far outweighing it is the quarterback. And so the sequence of events, as we eventually
saw it as if it was like some Zapruder-like analysis was basically Dak Prescott steps out of the huddle and so that he could spit. Now, the question is, if Jalen Carter's got an issue with it, why are you that close to their huddle? Are you trying to get some information? Are you trying to, you know, eavesdrop on something? And that goes back to what Pat says. You're starting to see players in areas where they shouldn't be and behaving in ways they shouldn't be. That immediately puts the red flag up and the antenna. And then it really comes down to the officiating that dead ball period, which is probably one of the most crucial parts. It's underrated from the common fans standpoint, but if you lose control of the dead ball period, you've lost control of the game.
Yeah, and that's where high school officials, I think, get into trouble a little bit, right? Sometimes we start ball watching and watching things we shouldn't. And the Florida, South Florida spitting incident was a lot harder to get, but the center judge did a really good job. Again, it was after a play. It wasn't as obvious as Jalen Carter, obviously, but it was after a play where two players started coming together and, you know, jawing each other. So that immediately draws an official to that location and then catching the spitting part. Because again, spit's clear typically, so it's sometimes hard to see if someone is spitting or not, especially from a long distance away. And, you know, on Friday nights when many of us are officiating high school football, kids are dumber and kids will do stupid things. And we need to do the same thing that these professionals are doing, too, is make sure we're on top of those dead ball situations.
Yeah, to your point, Ben, dead ball situations, if you're not on top of it, that's where you really lose control. That's where dumb things like people spitting on each other happen. And that's what starts fights if you're not on top of it.
And then the action that you see, and we run into this quite often when there's taunting and we get some response from people, well, you know, these are adults playing an adult game, you know, let them, if they want to do that, let them do that. They can handle it. But it's basically putting an action out there that has an expectation of a reaction. And so again, it's, you know, not a football act. It's not part of the game. And so therefore, you know, it gets penalized appropriately. And when it gets up to the level of spitting, I think we look back at it and pretty much establish the precedent, if you want, or more probably the more recent example, you know, that where it became the first in modern time was Sean Taylor in the wild card game. What was it, 2005, I think we said?
Basically, it was Mike Carey on the situation and immediately called for the ejection. And he says, well, yeah, what do you expect somebody to do in that situation? You know, we definitely saw that was, you know, it was pretty much an assault on another player. And there was no question about the ejection. And so that pretty much is followed suit throughout at the NFL level and probably a lot sooner at the lower levels.
Yep. So that was the 2005 season. As you were saying, more on a historical perspective, following that, you know, incident, the player that Sean Taylor spat at kind of retaliated, but it was just for the general, you know, hit to the head, open-handed slap to the head. It wasn't like he spat back at him. Like, we're kind of alleging in this, you know, like you said, this is a Pruder film kind of incident here. In that instance, you know, I believe the headlinesman in that game was Steve Stelgis with Mike Carey, and they discussed it, and Carey didn't want to offset the penalties, even though I believe it was Michael Pittman of the Buccaneers. He hit Sean Taylor back to retaliate for the spitting. And, you know, they chose not to offset those penalties. I should say they chose not to penalize Pittman and allow the fouls to offset. And I believe Mike Barrera agreed that, you know, offsetting personal fouls wouldn't have been appropriate in that circumstance. Now, again, if a circumstance happened like that, where it was a spit was the retaliation, then that may be another story. But you know, it's interesting to look at it from a historical perspective that only 20 years ago, which in the grand scheme of the NFL is not that long ago, there's some precedent with one of the best referees in league history that this has happened before.
And so, yeah, exactly. We're looking at a situation where you don't want to penalize the second action. It was just a natural reaction, but the fact that it wasn't flagrant, then you don't offset another flagrant foul. But yeah, there was that balance that did have to be discussed. And as you said, it was upheld. And being a playoff game, you know, there was even more scrutiny on what was happening there. One other thing that we saw crop up this weekend, and we know of a few people that are retired from the field that worked their way up to the booth in the coach's booth in an officiating capacity. We talked about this with John Perry, where he left ESPN. He wanted to take a job at the Bills. The offer was given to him, and so he took them up on it. Last season was his first season doing that. I had a great chat with John Perry when right before we broke the news, and it was just, he was saying how he pretty much had done everything. He's done a Super Bowl, and then he did network TV, and he's like, now this is something new and probably something to close out his career. So there's probably 32 of these people in various capacities. Some of them, you know, retired officials, some of them administrators or some officiating capacity behind them, maybe a replay. But basically you do need somebody upstairs that's going to help that coach make the decision to call for a challenge if it's warranted, or to, you know, discuss something with the official, something they didn't see that went their way. If it's not a challengeable thing, but something that they could point out, hey, we've seen this, you know, put a bug in their ear, as we've always alluded to. We ran into this with the Titans coach who wanted to challenge a catch at the sideline, or a potential catch, as to whether it was inbounds, out of bounds.
Yeah, you got to get a foot inbounds too, which we didn't have a clean look at whether his foot was down as well. An elbow doesn't equal 2 feet, so his foot would have had to come down as well. We didn't have a clean look, so the call from upstairs was that, you know, it wasn't worth challenging.
And of course, the big mistake in there is an elbow doesn't equal 2 feet. It absolutely does, because anything beyond the wrist doesn't count as the hand. And so an elbow down is another body part. So it's either 2 feet or another body part. And so that elbow would have been the criteria, as long as it lands in bounds first, would have been the criteria for completing the catch. Now there would be the other parts of it, you know, has the process completed and all of that. But as far as inbounds, out of bounds, that was a mistaken statement there. And then the question is, who was the call from upstairs? Was it somebody who was seasoned veteran official who said, oh no, you know, you don't want to challenge that because the elbow doesn't count? Or was there somebody that was just kind of guessing at it, some assistant coach?
If that is the officiating assistance that he has on game day, I can guarantee you it's not a former official, if they were one to say that. Guaranteed. I don't know who it is, but I'm guaranteeing you it's not a former official. And, you know, Brian Callahan, ask any of us. We can work for you. We'll be your officiating assistants on game day. I'm sure we'll give you some better advice. Because if based on what he said in that quote post game, the call from upstairs was that it wasn't worth challenging, that falls on that game day assistant that kind of failed there. You know, if you want to just go back to the late great John Madden, his 1986 book, One Knee Equals 2 Feet, the elbow is the knee of the arm. So it's, think of it that way. It's the exact same thing. And Ben, as you said, one of anything except feet or hands, and the wrist is included in the hand. So the elbow obviously is nowhere near that. But yeah, think of it like that. that the elbow is the knee of the arm. I like to think of it that way sometimes too. But again, it goes back to this new era that teams are moving in, getting officiating analysts or expertise as part of the team staff, as part of the club's organization. And who knows, maybe this will be an impetus for them to find somebody new. I'm not advocating for anybody losing their job, but that really wasn't the proper advice they should be receiving from the person in that position.
I think sometimes throughout the officiating community, we have varying opinions to the degree that coaches or broadcasters or whoever know the rules. And so sometimes seeing like this pop up kind of puts that in perspective. And especially, you know, some of these coaching staffs these days seem to have more coaches than players at times, you know, more coaches than you can count. It just seems like the natural progression to hire somebody who really knows the rules inside and out, or even like an ex-replay person who not only knows the rules in and out, is intimately familiar with what replay is looking for on any particular call and can give very accurate information.
Yeah, this is a multi-billion dollar industry, right? So they have plenty of budget to hire these people. And, you know, again, alluding to John Perry going there, I think the best teams will get the best people in the best positions and the ones that are most important. And, you know, for better or worse, the Titans didn't do that, which maybe is standard for the Titans. But yeah, I mean, it goes to show you how important it is, how important every position on the coaching staff is when, again, the head coach is kind of the, you know, the overseer of the team on the sidelines. They don't have time to know necessarily all the nuances of the rules. So, yep, go hire someone and get that expert in the booth to help you out.
And every team has somebody that's going to be that go-to person that figures out, you know, this is what we're going to do in these particular situations during the week. They're also the people who go through some of the officiating, you know, now the teams are getting some of the officiating tapes. And so they're understanding what the officials are looking at so that it helps inform them. Now you also can have somebody on the team who can parse out, okay, these are the things that they focused on. And on this particular play, they highlighted somebody, either your opponent, you, or someone who's in a similar situation as you, and they can actually coach specifically to the officiating tape, to the players. And again, that the idea is to, you know, we want to see less penalty. We see all these situations where they say, well, you know, the officials aren't there to be on TV. Well, this is a perfect example where if you have somebody who's well-versed on the team, not only are they helping the coach on Sunday, but during the week, they're helping the position coaches, the coordinators, and the head coach on specifically, you know, hitting either individual plays or players on specific rules-based things or things that are drawing the attention of the officiating department. When something starts to show up, like we had a story a couple of years ago that we broke about foreign objects being on the field. So somebody takes like a little golf marker, they put it down to mark the spot of the place kick, and that was illegal. It kind of got away from everybody, and then we started to pick up on some of these things on video, and then before you knew it, now there's a bulletin out that says, hey, we are going to enforce this. There's no foreign objects on the field, and then became a rule change the year later. I don't want to reach too far back to pat ourselves on the back, but that was part of the discussion at that particular time, and then we wound up finding a slew of examples, and it got shut down pretty quickly. So that's one of those things where if they start to see something like that on an officiating tape, that information is going to start to work its way towards the players and the coaches. And we have like about 5 minutes left, but we're just starting a new season of the podcast. Obviously, teams are hitting the field for the first time, some of them a few weeks in, especially down here in Florida. We're already 3 weeks into the football season. So basically, you know, preseason NFL, that's a chance for officials to kind of work on various things, check out some of the try and look at some of the new rules. They worked on some things with the virtual measurement and replay and six-man mechanics. If they were down by a official, they could do a crew of six and replace the referee. So all of these things that, you know, help you when the games count. Not that much of an opportunity for that at some of the lower levels. So my question is to the group here, how do you knock the rust off when you get out on the field? Because you got to be ready to go as soon as the toe hits ball.
I think, you know, first off, nothing, whether you're knocking the rust off or trying to get better, nothing beats live snaps. Around where I live, a lot of the D3 schools will scrimmage against each other. And that is, in my opinion, the best way to knock off some rust, because they're pretty damn near game speed. And it's a low pressure environment to just work on things, see some snaps, and kind of just get back up to game speed.
Yeah, when it comes to high school, I think, you know, we have scrimmages. They're probably less than ideal compared to what Pat runs into. Thankfully, we have underclass, you know, freshman JV games, which, you know, are they meaningful games to the kids? Absolutely. But it's also an opportunity for crews to try different positions, do different work on their mechanics and whatnot. Typically, our crew will, you know, again, swap people around, so everyone has experience at every position. So when you hit varsity on Friday night, you can handle any situation, whether it's an injury, whether, you know, typically for most of us on the high school side, it's not our full-time job. So somebody may be out of town a particular weekend, you know, we can adjust that way. So thankfully, I think that's a really useful thing, because, you know, we may have 9 weeks of a regular season for varsity, but we also have 9 weeks of freshman JV games to work in as well.
I know it's different than a lot of other places in the country, but up here in the New England area, particularly in the southern part of Massachusetts where I officiate, we just had our first week this past weekend. That was our first week of the regular season. So again, we also have scrimmages, but they're not as available. I'm in my fifth season now, and this is the first year I did not have a preseason scrimmage. So Friday night was my first time on the field since last December when I worked my state championship. And you can feel it. You can feel the rust, not only mentally, but also physically. And even though you try to stay in shape during the off season, it's a totally different thing when you step on the field for the first time after almost a year. I previously had done some spring football in prior years. I didn't do it this past year, but I've done some women's semi-pro up in Boston during the springtime, and that was very helpful to get some rust off. But, you know, like I said, the rust comes in multiple forms. It comes in physical rust. It comes in mental rust, remembering certain... I had a play in my game on Friday night where a defender jumped into the neutral zone. And in high school football, they don't have the opportunity to get back, whether they touch the offensive player or not. And it was the play was going to my left, so the defense was facing in the opposite direction, and it was the right defensive end right in front of me. He hopped over the line and jumped back. And key example of rust, I didn't do anything. My head linesman on the other side picked it up, and I was like, at halftime, I went up to him and I said, I don't know what I was thinking on that one. That I'm just chalking up to rust. I haven't been on the field, not making excuses, but, you know, something normally a few weeks into the season is something you're going to nail. Very simple stuff. You know, it comes up. But again, getting those opportunities to do scrimmages up in the board that I work, we also have a preseason clinic for first, second, and third year officials. I help at that every year. So that is a good way to help not only get the newer officials going, but also we have a lot of veterans attend that too. In by being a mentor, that's also, even though it's not taking live snaps as much as a scrimmage or a preseason game or a sub varsity game, you're also knocking off rust that way by getting your mind back into the, you know, the your pre-snap routine and things you're looking for during the play, your keys and things like that. So again, it's going to be different all across the country. It's going to vary, but as long as you're ready to go by the time, you know, Friday night rolls around, then you're really in the right place.
And with that brings us to the end of our first episode of the second season. Thank you for listening to the First and 25 podcast, and we'll catch you next time.